Okay, I guess that we are ready to go.
Yes, Chair.
Just one moment, sir.
All right.
Chair, the floor is yours.
Yep.
Ready?
Yes, sir, we are.
Thank you. Good morning, actually afternoon, members, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Pete Pumphrey, and I am the board chair. I want to thank you for listening to our meeting. We welcome your comments, ideas, and participation because they help us to do a better job. Today's board meeting is being conducted during the COVID-19 emergency and is a virtual board meeting. In order to comply with the public gathering and physical distancing requirements in the governor's executive orders, there is no physical meeting room. Bob Lloyd with AGP Video is hosting our virtual board meeting. I will ask him to give you some instructions to help us run this meeting smoothly. Bob?
I'm sorry, I was off microphone.
That's okay. All right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please mute your microphones when you're not speaking. All board members will stay on video. For those members of the public, when the item is called, you may use the raise hand feature to be pulled up as far as being allowed to speak. And I think that would cover it.
Thank you, sir. It's reassuring to know that even the professionals forget sometimes to unmute, because I forget all the time. So we appreciate your patience and understanding during this extraordinary time. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board attending via video and teleconference. Kimberly Cox from Hallandale, Keith Diaz from Rosamond, Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee.
Hi there.
Don Jardine from Markleyville.
Hello.
And Eric Sandell, also from Truckee.
Hi, all. I'm waving my hand.
Our executive board staff are here today, including our executive officer, Mike Plasiak, our legal counsel, Elizabeth Barrett, and our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman. We will also be joined by other staff members for individual agenda items. Oops. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment, you should have submitted a virtual speaker card to our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman, and be in the Zoom meeting room. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. If you think you might be interested in commenting or are experiencing technical difficulties, please contact our board clerk promptly at katrinafleshman@waterboards.ca.gov. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. Our board clerk will unmute you when it is your turn. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute again. With that, we will go to our first board item, public forum. And I might add that I believe the agenda shows that we will be going into closed session at the end of tomorrow. That has been changed. We will be going into closed session at the end of today's items, which I believe ends with item number 8. When we do go into closed session, I believe there are also some materials in your mailbox relating to the closed session. This is for board members, of course, only. Given that, item 1 on the agenda is public forum. Any person may address the water board regarding a matter within the water board's jurisdiction that is not related to a matter on the meeting agenda or currently pending before the water boards. I do not have any speaker cards for this item. I don't know if there's anyone who wishes to speak to public comment. and didn't get a speaker card in, if there is, please use your raise hand feature or let us know that you wish to comment. Hearing no response, item two are the minutes, discussion and adoption of the minutes of the regular meeting of the board of January 13 and 14, 2021.
I'll make a motion. We approve the minutes. This is Keith.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Been moved and seconded. Any comment or discussion? If not, board member Cox.
Aye.
Mr. Diaz.
Aye.
Dr. Horn.
Aye.
Mr. Jardine.
Aye.
Mr. Sandell.
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. Thank you. Item three, reports by Water Board Chair and board members. I believe, although I can't tell from looking at my screen, but I believe we're being joined by Sean McGuire from the State Water Board, who wishes to give us an update on activities from Sacramento. And I can see him now. And welcome to our meeting, Sean. It's always nice of you to take the time to keep us up to date.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to join you, even though it's virtually now. But good afternoon, Chair Pumphrey and members of the board. You know, my name is Sean McGuire. I'm a State Water Board member. And this is my, you know, I attempt to make it diligently to every one of your board meetings to provide my state board report, just so we can better ensure that we have just a productive and ongoing dialogue between regional board, you, and the state board, in that there is a lot of overlapping interest and activities. And so today, what I thought I would do is share with you our state board's 2021 strategic work plan. I know that you have I think you have an item on your agenda for maybe tomorrow to talk about your priorities for the upcoming fiscal year. And so I thought it might be helpful just to give you a little sense for what we're doing at the state board. So I have a PowerPoint I'd like to share. I don't know if someone can put that up. Do you have it?
Just one moment. We're getting that together.
Okay. Well, anyway, while we're waiting, you know, I want to emphasize that, you know, in the, oh, there we go. So, you know, in the strategic planning effort, there's really no right or wrong way to approach this process. We started on this initiative a couple of years ago, once Chair Joaquin Esquivel was appointed. We started talking about, now that, you know, we had a new state board, essentially with two new members, myself and Laurel Firestone, and a new chair with Chair Esquivel, we decided to, you know, take another look at the board's strategic plan and you know, our priorities, so we could realign and focus on areas that needed additional attention. Because as you'll see here shortly, there's a very long list of things, of important tasks that we all have. You know, your board has the same challenge, I think, with basically more projects, more programs than you have resources to tackle at any given time. So you have to prioritize and make those trade-off decisions. So that's what we've done here. Again, this is just one way to look at it, and not, you know, there's no magic or mystery behind what we've done here. So the other thing is that a lot of our programs are, you know, multi-year efforts. So you'll see a little bit of a mixed bag in terms of, you know, shorter term projects that we're trying to complete in this calendar year 2021, and then others that take a lot of resources and staff time, and we admit are multi-year and long-term efforts and investments on issues like the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan, for example. So Just a little perspective there as well. So if you could go to the next slide, please. So I'm sure you've all seen this before as board members, but just for anyone in the public in particular who hasn't, I always find it helpful to just revisit the board's mission. And that is to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of California's water resources and drinking water for the protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses, and to ensure proper water resource allocation and efficient use for the benefit of present and future generations. So that is a lofty goal, but a noble mission, I would say, in general, is that we are trying to grapple with wanting to have all of the above. You know, we want healthy ecosystems. We want water for our cities, and we want robust agriculture in California. We want all of that. And sometimes they come into conflict, those uses. And so our job, you know, your job at the regions, our job at the state board, is to look at those and figure out, you know, what does that balancing look like? How do we protect those uses to the maximum extent possible? And if you go to the next slide, please. So at the state board, just again, as a reminder, you know, obviously the regional boards are focused predominantly on water quality. At the state board, we have a little bit of a broader umbrella of issues that we look at. You know, predominantly with our water rights responsibility and water allocation, which you'll be hearing a little bit more about. But also, actually, our 5-6 or maybe 6 years ago now, actually, it was the tail end of the last drought, where the Division of Drinking Water was brought over to the State Water Resources Control Board. You know, that obviously relates to water quality, but that has become a very large focus of our efforts over recent years, as it relates to safe and affordable drinking water. And of course, our largest division, at the board is our Division of Financial Assistance. So that's always the good part, is that, you know, every year we issue, it varies, but hundreds of millions of dollars to sometimes over $1 billion of grant and state revolving fund loans. And so that's a really exciting and just really critical part of what we do to make sure those necessary, you know, either wastewater treatment, you know, habitat restoration, drinking water projects are moving forward and are funded and have those resources so that they can move forward. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our compliance and Office of Enforcement and those responsibilities, because, you know, incentives are good, but there always, of course, needs to be accountability in what we do. And so we have that responsibility as well. Next slide. So our strategic plan has four goals, four overarching goals. And I actually had to count, and I'm not going to go over all of this with you, but I had to drill down into all of our individual project headings. And there's actually 81 different projects or actions that are kind of embedded in our priorities list. And it's not even everything that the boards have, all the projects that we have underway. These are just the ones that were top priorities that we decided warranted being included in this plan. So there's actually quite a few more that didn't even make the list. But the first one, as I've already alluded to, is protecting public health by ensuring reliable access to safe, affordable drinking water and sanitation. So, you know, that's, you know, so much of what we do. This past year, it was moving forward with the safe and affordable drinking water program that was provided through SB 200 and the $130 million a year of funding we now have to assist communities that are struggling with safe drinking water. This includes, and there's a lot going on in that space right now. This includes things like addressing emerging contaminants like PFAS, microplastics, which we have a lot going on with right now as well. And hopefully later this year, finally considering a new MCL for hexavalent chromium. So, you know, when we're thinking about drinking water and think about safe and affordable drinking water, it's that mix of acknowledging that there's, you know, several hundred water systems at any given point that are essentially out of compliance in California. And you may have heard, you know, a million Californians don't have access to safe drinking water. And that's that number that we work with and are faced with every day. And, you know, at the same time, we have emerging contaminants or contaminants that have been longstanding that we know of, that we're trying to be proactive in making sure that those standards are in place, so that we can continue to protect public health that way. So that's our goal number one and a big focus for us right now. Next slide. That's not to diminish anything else. And so our second one is protecting and restoring watersheds, marine waters, and ecosystems. And, you know, you do a lot of work in this area, of course, as well. When you look at your water quality control plans and beneficial use protection, water quality objectives, and all that. You know, when I was thinking about this one, it kind of leans towards water rights and thinking about in-stream flows and the use of water management to help support beneficial uses as well. And so that's an area where I know you've been interested in, that we can continue to work together on. But areas like Moto Lake, for example, where there's a lot of work going on there, this really speaks to to, you know, our water stewardship and protecting fish and wildlife and other uses. So, you know, emerging areas there, for example, with harmful algal blooms, as we're looking at climate change and how that's proliferating, and the connection between water flows, temperatures, nutrients, you know, other issues are all areas that we're focusing on right now. But also, you know, things like stormwater management, trash, you know, initiatives that we've been challenged with for so long. You've done a lot of great work there, you know, especially in the Lake Tahoe area. But, you know, statewide, we have a long ways to go to achieve our objectives when it comes to stormwater management. So that's all I wanted to say on that one. If you could go to the next slide, please. And, you know, speaking of climate change and where we're headed, I would imagine that we all hopefully share similar priorities as it relates to water resiliency and climate change adaptation, in that we all, I'm sure, want robust access to drinking water and water supplies for all the different needs. And so this goal for me is really about building our toolbox of water supply options for long range water supply. And even, you know, shorter term challenges, I think you probably have seen or are experiencing, you know, this year we are facing somewhat dry conditions, kind of jury's out still as to whether this is, you know, the second dry year in a row or worse. I'm obviously happy that it's hopefully snowing in your area right now or near to you for most of you. And it's certainly been raining here today in Sacramento. But we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed that those conditions will continue for a while. But for me, it's been a reminder that we have a lot of good initiatives underway here. When you look at urban water conservation standards are coming up within the next year and a half. You'll start to hear a lot more about that this year, about indoor and outdoor water use standards that were actually an outgrowth from the last drought. The ongoing implementation of SGMA is a big deal. You're going to hear a lot more about that as well through our partner agency with DWR. And, you know, looking at areas that we can better support stormwater capture and use as a resource, you know, that's another area that we're looking at pretty closely. We have a storms initiative, which does focus on that. But there's more work that we need to do there, especially as it looks to just incentivizing those types of projects and just really understanding what their costs and benefits are. So, and how to quantify stormwater capture. So more work to come there. And so those are all priorities for us that move to the top. You could go to the next slide. And so the last goal, it says strengthen internal capacity and systems. And actually, as I was reading through the sub goals, to me, it's really not just internal. It really is an externally facing organization that we have at the State Board. And you can see that, you can look at any of these bullets. incorporate effective public participation in the state water board decisions and support effective partnerships, track and communicate the water board's work, manage data effectively, and support evolution of organizational structures, processes, and culture. So for us, this is really about being equitable in all of our approaches in our business. We have our racial equity initiative now, which you'll, again, be hearing more about very soon, which strives to look at both, racial equity and environmental injustice issues statewide with our permittees and the watersheds and the communities that we work with, but also internally with our staff and our hiring practices and those implicit bias issues and all those other challenges that we've faced as a state. And really trying to turn the page on that and have a deep conversation and acknowledge the work that is still needed there. So, for us and for me, this is really an important goal for us to have to embody kind of our ongoing desire for robust public processes that are fair and equitable in everything that we do. And a lot of that has to do with information. So looking at data, making data more readily available, whether it's through our Open Data Initiative or other programs that we have. And we've really invested a lot in that over recent years. We still have a lot more work to do there to get our data in better shape on all fronts. But I think, I completely agree with our board when we added this goal that it's just an important heading to remind ourselves of, how there's always room for improvement in our institution and our governance, and looking inside, but also looking externally is important. Next slide. So real quickly, our first strategic work plan was in 2020. So we did take a look back to say, hey, how did we do? And these are just, a few of the kind of accomplishments from last year. Obviously, we've all adapted under COVID-19. And I think I've demonstrated that we can continue with our business as a board. At the same time, we're also looking forward to going back to being able to meet in person and being able to work in person or some sort of hybrid from where we are now. And that's, I think, where we're giving a lot of thought. We established our administrative hearings office, which deals with water rights hearings for the first time outside the board. And that's been very successful so far. They've been really accelerated that backlog and addressing those issues, which have been longstanding. We adopted the toxicity provisions for water quality protection statewide. I already talked to you about safe and affordable drinking water. We've continued the PFAS investigations. We've made other investments to look at our backlog on hydropower projects for water quality certifications there, which is a huge challenge. And of course, we adopted new laboratory regulations for our ELAP program. And so I look at 2020 and there's a whole long list of other things that we did, but these were the ones that rose to the top for me. And I'm just really proud of what we were still able to accomplish, even with the adversity and the challenges that we faced with the ongoing pandemic. Next slide. And so, looking forward, looking at 2021, of the 81 or so projects that we have, these are the ones that got special asterisks next to them. And our strategic work plan is on our website. So you're free to go take a look at it and download and read it as you wish. But these are the ones that we've committed to invest additional staff resources and other resources to if needed, and just to ensure that these projects continue, whether they're one year project or multi-year. So we have two check marks on there so far with things that we've already done. So we adopted the total coliform rule and also the winery process water general order. And then we've got a whole slew of other things on here, which I think I've mentioned most of these to you already in one form or another, but just wanted to share this list with you. So with that, can you go to the next slide, please? And that's it. So I just wanted to show that, for me, this update is really for you to engage in a dialogue with the State Board if you wish. I'm open to any questions. It can be on anything I presented or anything else for that matter that, you know, relates to our relationship and working together. And, you know, totally open. So any questions?
Let's see. They're repairing the road outside my house, so I hope that it doesn't bleed too much into my microphone. Any questions, comments, Dr. Cox? That works.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciated Sean's presentation. Thank you for taking your time to be with us today.
You bet.
Mr. Diaz?
No questions. Thank you. And thank you, Sean, for joining us.
Dr. Horn?
Well, I'm just going to echo everything that everybody else has said so far. Sean, I really appreciate the efforts you make to maintain a liaison with our board and that you took the time to put together this presentation for us. I really am grateful to you for that. So.
Thank you. Mr. Jardine?
Just a quick comment. When I graduated eighth grade down at Woodford School, there were eight Washoe children and myself. So we got to know each other fairly well. And I've had a fairly good relationship with the Washoe tribe. And that's it. Thank you.
Mr. Sandell.
I'll echo all the other comments. Thanks very much for showing up. I really appreciate getting this kind of update. It's so comprehensive, but I hope you'll continue to show up at our meetings.
Of course.
Thank you. I would echo what everyone else has said. It really is important to maintain contact and communication with you folks. I have the advantage of being able to participate in the chair's calls, and so that gives me some extra opportunity to get information about what's happening in Sacramento and with the state board. But it really is useful and helpful to us, and I know you've got a ton of stuff, six or seven slides that and 78 more or whatever the additional number of priorities that you weren't able to include in the slides on your plate. And so it really is a blessing to us that you take the time to keep us clued in, and I appreciate it very much.
If I can, yes. I'm going to give a history talk of the east side of the Sierras. That's coming up. Our historical society, you know, Monitor Pass, Ebbets Pass, and I'm not quite sure when they're planning that out, but Snowshoe Thompson, when we lived up on Monitor Pass, and different things. Anyways, I'll give you guys an update.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. McGuire.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you all. I appreciate the feedback. And, you know, as always, if there's something, you know, in the future that you'd like to hear about or discuss, I'm open to ideas. You know, I'm trying to come up with things that would be helpful to you. And so, yeah, this is what I thought I'd start with today. But I will be back. And just always interested to get your input and make this as productive as possible. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any report, Board Member Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No reports.
Any report, Board Member Diaz?
No reports, thank you.
Board Member Horn?
Yeah, I have an issue I'd like to bring up for discussion with the board. So as you all know, I have been closely following and participating in sort of statewide efforts to improve headwater watersheds, and including following the reports that's being put out by the Water Policy Center of the Public Policy Center of California, or Institute of California. And those reports lop off the Lahontan region completely. They show the forest ending at the Sierra Crest. Now, I've spoken to them about this in person, and I have emailed the author, the lead author of the report, asking that they include the Lahontan region for a number of reasons. One is our region supplies, last I heard, 30% of LA's water. That's significant. We're not, you know, it's not just the West Slope that supplies statewide water. Money's going to restore watersheds are just as important over here where a lot of people live. We are affected by wildfires just as much as the West Slope is. We need to have our forests thinned and the impacts of all that on water quality. Now, so far, my efforts at getting them to include the Lahontan region in their consideration of headwaters has not gone anywhere. And so I was just thinking it might be time to elevate the message to PPIC so that they take us seriously. And I'm wondering if people have thoughts on the best way to do that.
My initial thought, Mr. McGuire, are you still with us by any chance? I think that maybe sending this on to the state board, that's a place to start. We as a board could authorize the executive officer perhaps to send a letter expressing our concern over that. We could communicate the situation to other groups within the region, maybe Irwin groups, something like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was wondering if it would be effective if we as a board signed a letter and together.
I agree with that idea.
And sent a board. And I'd be happy to draft something for people's consideration. And, you know, Mike can sign it too if he feels, if he can agree with the statement.
I totally agree.
I think it's more likely to be taken seriously if it comes from the region and we speak with one voice. If it goes up to the state board, I'm afraid, you know, just get lost among the zillion other priorities they have. So
it probably won't hurt to run it by Sean and perhaps other contacts we have. And Mike might be able to help in that.
That's a good point. I mean, we could see if Sean would be willing to sign a letter too.
Yeah.
All right.
Any other thoughts? I'd do whatever I can do to help that.
All right. Perfect.
Thank you. It's like you look at their maps and it's like, God, you know, a quarter of California is missing from this map.
Maybe we could get them to come to one of our meetings and fill us in on what they do and all of that. And we could grill them.
You know, I have tried for years to get them to come and address our board. What's his name? And I mean, so far, you know, they've been ducking us. So.
Can we subpoena them?
These are all good ideas. I'll write something and think about what we should do next. Thank you all.
Yeah, it might be useful also to send that along to our friends from Los Angeles and ask them if they have any concerns that California is not planning for their headwaters.
Good point.
That's a very good idea. That's
yeah.
Great.
30% of your water.
Mike, can you help us with that, with having a liaison with LADWP about this?
I can help.
Sure.
Yeah. Too.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
That's the notes down here right now. Yep.
Great.
All right.
Anything else, Dr. Horn? Thank you so much for that.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Mr. Jardine, anything else?
Oh, nothing. You're over the top. Dr. Horn, and total in support. Good Lord. Anyways, that's it for me.
Mr. Sandell?
No reports, thank you.
I just have one brief thing. The chair's call this past week was devoted mainly just to kind of a reintroduction of ourselves to each other. There are some new chairs in a couple of the regions. Chairs meeting is going to be May 14th. At least that's the most recent announced date. And the agenda for that is yet to be developed. And a quick update on the equity initiative at the state board level. At the end of March, they're going to be conducting listening sessions with all the water board employees as part of putting together a draft resolution, which the state board, I guess, is expecting to take up in April. And that was really all that we had time to talk about last week. I will definitely give you an update after we have the meeting about what we were able to get to and talk about. Item four, the executive officer's report, Mr. Plasiak.
Thank you, Chair Pumphrey. Mike Plasiak, executive officer for the Lahontan region. I'm going to start out first talking about personnel issues. And as I've briefed you in the past during January's board meeting, we are working on filling vacancies. The state board has given us a green light to proceed forward. So one of the key vacancies, as you know, is the AEO position, the assistant executive officer. I'm happy to inform you that the announcement was posted last week. We have a closing date of March 17th. For final applications. I am forming a review panel consisting of some other executive officers from other regions and expect through that process to be able to select an AEO by mid-April. So that's the big news on that. We filled a scientific aid position here just a month and a half ago, and that is in Dan Sussman's planning and assessment unit. And please welcome Megan Walsh. And she comes to us from the Great Basin Outdoor School in Reno, where she also continues to work as a program director and naturalist. She holds a degree in geology and is going to be very helpful in the planning and assessment unit in sampling, lab and equipment maintenance, and data collection. So we're really happy to have her on board. We get real great people. So good snag from Dan's unit. We still have three environmental scientists that we are looking to fill. That is progressing nicely in Doug Cushman's dredge and fill unit. Interviews are being scheduled, so we should be able to see that being filled in the next couple of weeks. The environmental scientist in Rob Tucker's regulatory enforcement unit, we're working with HR for the paperwork, so we should get that announcement out here very shortly. And lastly, in Mary Fury Wagner's non-point source unit, we've interviewed and we expect to have a candidate selected here within the next week. So those are the good news. The bad news is that we're going to be losing Mark Lemus. He's going to be departing JCAS's Ag and Regulatory Unit at the end of this month, and he got stolen from us by Region 3. So we'll lose him at the end of the month, and he was working with JCAS. So that's another vacancy that we'll be looking to fill. So that's that on the personnel status. Are there any questions on that from the board?
Does not appear, sir.
All right.
No.
Give it a short pause and I'll go on to the next item. And that is on another positive note, we just received $66,000 from the state freshwater harmful algal bloom program. And that was the work that Mary Fury Wagner and her scientific aide, Sabrina Rice, put together a proposal. Proposal was accepted by state board. And this is good news for us because, as you know, that one of those vacancies is to fill the harmful algal bloom person that's going to be in Mary Fury Wagner's unit. So there's some money that's coming into the program or into the unit, and that's going to help them with partnerships, special studies, and also monitoring at high elevation lakes. So we're glad to see that. And on top of that, we've got 20% matching funds from the swamp funds. And the others in the, within the region that worked on that. So we'll have about $83,000 total in funds that are going to go towards those harmful algal bloom responses. So just wanted to update the board on that. I'm going to start now with the EO items, and item number 4 in the EO items, you'll find that on bait stamp 4-8. And that's the confined animal facility status update. And as you know, in the past, we've updated the board on our dairy strategy. And back in 2010, we did that. It had 4 components, and those components still are in play. First component, risk to groundwater, downgradient receptors from exposure to nitrate and TDS. So that's the first focus. Secondly, require source controls to reduce nitrate and TDS loading to groundwater. Third, adequate monitoring to evaluate the extent of groundwater pollution. And fourth, groundwater remediation where beneficial uses are impaired. So of those 4 components, the first two, risk to downgradient receptors and source controls, are what we've been putting our limited resources on. We do have monitoring at some select dairies, and mostly though, production wells, local residences, and the like. What you'll find on bait stamp page 4-10 is table 4.2, and that's talking about our strategy. So we've got 4 steps that we're going to take on that. Focused outreach, and this is to develop the combined animal facility general order. As you know, that has been something that we've had in the wings, and I think that we're at a point now where we can put traction and certainly incorporate that into the work plan for next fiscal year. But we've got 4 components that we're going to work on that. Outreach to our stakeholders. We did outreach from 2012 to 2018. We need to pick that back up. There's been a 3-year lapse there. Get our stakeholders back into the room and ensure that we're addressing equities there. We've got the CEQA scoping to do, and then we'll be doing the combined animal facilities order development, and then bringing that order in the CEQA document to the board probably by the end of fiscal year 22-23. So about 1.5 years from now. So that's the status where we are in that. I expect to see that incorporated into our work plans for some of those earlier components that I mentioned. Going on to the next item, and that's item 3 on bait stamp page 4-30. And that's development of another order, and that's the non-point source permit on federal lands. And as you know, we've had that in the works also over the last, I would say, last couple of years. And that's a joint effort between the Lahontan Water Board and the Central Valley Water Board. So the status, and that's to regulate, if you will, land activities that are going on U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands, which we have a large amount of those land areas in our region. So this joint permit has been underway for quite some time. Well, we've made some progress jointly. On March 2nd, we had a meeting with the U.S. Forest Service and BLM executives to go over the schedule. We talked about the main permit requirements, got an idea of get some responses back from the executives of those two agencies, and then we talked about establishing quarterly meetings so we can continue the dialogue now that we're gaining momentum. And by that momentum, I mean we've got some key milestones that are coming up here in the very short term. In fact, the CEQA scoping meeting has just been, notice of proposed action has gone out, and we are having a CEQA scoping meeting on April 7th. So that's a month away. And the notice of preparation went out this week. So we expect to see that. The schedule for bringing this general order to the board is going to be accomplished in 3 phases, and with permit adoption around February of 2023. So we're currently in phase 1, which is the CEQA scoping, and we'll bring the more information to the board as we start to go through the different phases. I want to move next to the city of Barstow nitrate and update you on that. And this is found on bait stamp page 4-35. The key takeaways from this are that we're seeing a decrease in nitrate trends in residential wells, which is good news. If you look at figure 7-1 or 7.1, you'll see the concentrations are out actually towards the east, down gradient of the plume. Currently, the city is providing replacement water to residents as the groundwater exceeds 5 milligrams per liter. Nitrate is in. And fewer residences are exceeding that threshold now. When they started this under a clamp and abatement order, 16 of residences were receiving replacement water. Or I should say 16 residences were exceeding the threshold. 10 of them now are exceeding the threshold. So the high concentrations are starting to dwindle or starting to go down, as I was saying before. In the fall of 2020, we saw the high concentrations around 17 to 20 milligram per liter nitrate is in, but just in the recent monitoring over the first quarter of this year, those have gone down also. So it's moved, if you will, the centroid of the plume is kind of shifted towards the east down gradient. And why that's happening partly is because the nitrate plume is in terms of containment, that's not going on in terms of a focused remediation, because that nitrate plume, as you know, is commingled with perchlorate from another source further up gradient. So that's got to be dealt with. The perchlorate has to be dealt with before the city of Barstow attempts to start a remediation on the nitrate plume. But that's where we are with that. I know that one of the things that the city has asked us to evaluate, and we'll look into this in our upcoming work planning, and that is whether or not it's appropriate and applicable now to reduce the sampling frequency or to increase the threshold above what it currently is, and or also considering a plan to cease replacement water. That's something that they've asked for us to look into, and that's on our horizon to take a look at. I want to switch to the next topic, and that is, and it's related, and that's the city of Barstow perchlorate plume. So I should say that this is not a result of any discharge that the city perpetrated or put into the groundwater. This is from a different independent discharge unrelated to the city, and it's up gradient of the Soap Mine Road area. So that's why this is created such a problem for the city of Barstow with their plume. This is found in bait stamp 4-38. So the key takeaways from this are, and as you can see in the figure of 8-1, that plume is very narrow. It's about 2.5 miles long, and it does extend into Soap Mine Road area. Again, hence the reason why we're saying that it's commingled with the nitrate plume. So your staff have been going out on a quarterly basis. They've been doing monitoring of both residential wells and monitoring wells. And the next round of residential monitoring wells will be in April. So next month, they'll do another round. The good news is that we've got $2.2 million to apply towards a consultant firm to do a focused feasibility study and remedial design. And that's going to come to us in June. We already have a good idea what is going to be in that document. And it's going to focus on source area remediation. And I think it's a great first step. They're looking at doing some composting in the shallow soil with some enhanced aerobic remediation, or I should say anaerobic remediation in the deep soil. So, you know, it's expected that those perchlorate concentrations are going to go down further down from the plume. So, and they're also predicting that it'll be about a year for remediation, and that's of the soil. So that's the good news. We're expecting that report in June. Replacement water continues to be provided to residences under disadvantaged community guidelines, and that's 6 residents that are receiving replacement water. I just signed a request for extending the contract for not 1 year, but 2 years. And so they'll be getting replacement water out to 2023. So that's the situation there with the plumes in the city of Barstow. And lastly, I just want to just touch on the spills, and you'll find that on bait stamp 4-41. Most of those spills are requiring no further action. So I'm not going to go into the details on those. We've had a few. We have one that it was on I-80 a month ago or so with about 100 gallons of diesel. That is going to be remediated. It's bermed off. It's got visqueen over it, and that's going to be remediated. At least the soil will be removed once the snow is gone this spring. But the point that I wanted to bring your attention to is the first item, and that's the sunken motorboat in the Lake Tahoe. And why I'm bringing it up is I know, board members, you've seen some emails about this particular issue, but this speaks to a combined effort by a number of agencies to figure out how do you get a boat out of the lake that is sunk. It you know, typically you'd go to the owner and say, please remove it. Through our staff's efforts, I want to shout out to Carrie O'Keefe and Jeff Brooks. They went through the painstaking work of finding out who it was owned to, what the characteristics of or the boat, what different agencies' response protocols were. As we worked through this whole effort with El Dorado County, US EPA, TRPA, also with OSPR from CDFW, and trying to figure out how do we get this out. Ultimately, we went to the state board and the cleanup and abatement account, and Leslie Loudon provided assistance on that, and we had funds geared up to get that boat removed. EPA was able to step in a day earlier than us, and so they took lead on the removal. Their emergency response program stepped in, and the boat is now out. It's actually at the transfer station waiting to be removed, and here in Tahoe. So the good news is that was removed soon. You know, the concern was with that type of a boat, it's about a 42-foot motorboat, had about 265 gallons of fuel capacity. We didn't know how much was in there, and we were trying to get ahead of this before there was a plume or before there was some environmental damage. So I think we got an action together. Bottom line up front, we're going to end up coming back to this issue in the future with the staff and other agencies and look at designing or implementing a better protocol so we can be more responsive. And that's the lesson or the key takeaway from that removal. So with that being said, that is all I have to brief the board on. Are there any questions?
Let's see. Board Member Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No questions. I enjoyed reading the confined animal feeding lot update. Lots has been going on there, so thank you for that detail.
Mr. Diaz?
Good report. No questions. Thank you.
Board Member Horn?
Ditto and ditto. Thank you.
Board Member Jardine?
No problem. Ditto. Great report.
Board Member Sandell.
I read the report of the raising of the sunken boat with great interest. Thanks for the thorough coverage on that, Mike, and for taking care of it. How long was it down?
I think the boat had been discovered sunk in January, and we became aware of it in February. So
quite a while then, really.
Yes.
We're fortunate that nothing happened environmentally.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Staff did a great job on that.
Sorry. Excuse me. Thank you for an excellent report. I found the written report particularly useful and informative. So thank you very much. Move to items 5 and 6. of the agenda, which are uncontested calendar items. Items 5 and 6 are uncontested. Would any board member or anyone from the public like to request discussion and remove the items from uncontested calendar to be considered separately? I'm going to start by asking if there's any board member that wants to do that. And I'm not hearing that there are any. So let me ask if there's any member from the public who would make that request. They can use the raise your hand feature if you would like to request discussion.
And at this time, Chair, there is nobody raising their hands.
Thank you. Do I have a motion then from the board to adopt the uncontested items?
I move adoption of the uncontested items on our calendar.
Is there a second? Thank you. Board Member Cox.
Aye.
Board Member Diaz.
Aye.
Board Member Horn.
Aye.
Board Member Jardine.
Don, it looks like you're muted.
Aye.
Board Member Sandell.
Aye.
And I vote aye as well.
I'd just like to say it's great to see uncontested items on our calendar again. I feel like we're getting back to the old days.
I second that. And also for these old, old things to finally get taken care of. It's great.
Yes.
Item 7, consideration of adoption of renewed national pollutant discharge elimination system permit and a time schedule order for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Hot Creek Fish Hatchery located in Mono County. The board will now consider adopting the NPDES permit and time schedule order for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Hot Creek Fish Hatchery. The board will consider or conduct this hearing rather as follows. First, there'll be a presentation by Water Board staff. Secondly, there will be a presentation and or comments from the discharger. Thirdly, comments from any other interested parties. I have 3 speaker cards with respect to this item. If there's anyone who wishes to comment who has not submitted a card, please do so at this time. This hearing will not be conducted according to the technical rules of evidence. The board will accept comments that are reasonably relevant to the matter under consideration. The chair may impose reasonable time limits and require groups to select a single spokesperson. All persons who expect to testify, please raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is the truth? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
I do.
Thank you. When it is your turn to speak, please state your name and affiliation and whether or not you had taken the oath before testifying. Once the hearing and discussion have concluded, the board members will first consider the adoption of the proposed NPDES permit and then consider the adoption of the proposed time schedule order. So they will be considered as 2 separate items. First, presentation by the staff, please.
Bob, can you get the PowerPoint up, please? And then I need...
Yes, ma'am. Please stand by. We're about to give you control.
Okay.
You can go ahead and give it a try. I think you got it.
I do. I can't see the bottom of the screen, though.
Okay. Put your cursor onto the PowerPoint. Click once.
Yes.
Move your cursor down to the corner.
I don't see it.
Okay.
Well,
while this is getting geared up, I just want to introduce, this is Wendy Wiles. Wendy is a retired annuitant who has worked for years been in the state board system, and she has great wealth of knowledge on MPDS permits. And we're very lucky and fortunate to have Wendy assisting us with our limited resources to address this particular permit. So I just wanted to introduce Wendy before she starts her presentation.
Thank you. It is pretty much impossible to express how much we appreciate her being available to help us and the assistance that she's provided on this item.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it looks like I've got control now so of the screen. So I'll go ahead and start. Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Wiles, and I'm an environmental program manager, retired annuitant with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. And I have taken the oath. I've been helping your staff with several enforcement cases, and I also offered to help with the renewal of this permit for the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Hot Creek Fish Hatchery. So today I'll provide a summary of the proposed permit and the time schedule order. I'll start with an overview of the fish hatchery and then provide background about the 2006 permit and the three time schedule orders that were issued because of problems with that permit. I'll then move on to the differences between the 2006 permit and this proposed permit, and then I'll explain why we've also prepared a time schedule order and what it requires. And finally, I'll discuss the public comments and our recommendation. The Hot Creek Fish Hatchery is in Mono County, south of Mono Lake, and just south and east of the town of Mammoth Lakes. The hatchery is owned by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, while the landowners are the U.S. Forest Service and the L.A. Department of Water and Power. Fish have been raised here since the 1920s because the hot springs that supply the hatchery are warm enough that fish grow quickly year-round. The wastes discharged by the hatchery include fish food, fish excrement, and aquaculture drugs and chemicals. So the hatchery layout is a little complicated, and I'll go over this map with you, and then I'll show you photos of the main points. So we're going to start with the surface water, and if you follow this little red dot, the hatchery is at the headwaters of Hot Creek, and the headwaters are in this general area here where there's some springs are. Just beyond the hatchery, the Hot Creek flows just to the north side of the hatchery along here. And then just beyond the hatchery, Mammoth Creek enters Hot Creek. And then from there on, it's called Hot Creek, and it flows south and east to Lake Crowley. The hatchery captures water produced by four main springs. The first spring is in this area. This is Influent 1. The second spring is in this area. It's Influent 2. And water from these two springs is mixed, and then it flows into the four long raceways that you see here. As water exits the raceways, it enters, it's just split actually, and half enters Settling Pond 1, half enters Settling Pond 2, and then both settling ponds discharge to Hot Creek in this location. The third spring is down here. Water is captured from this area, and it goes into a raceway and a hatchery building before being discharged into this settling pond. And then from there, it flows into Hot Creek. And then there is a fourth spring over here. Water is captured from this spring and it goes into the raceway and hatchery building. And then it discharges directly to a tributary to Hot Creek over here. There's no settling pond associated with this spring. There's one more item to point out, and that's the domestic wastewater ponds. My tag is in quite a little bit the wrong place. The domestic ponds are actually down here at the bottom of this slide. They are four percolation evaporation ponds, and I'll talk more about these ponds when I discuss the time schedule order. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some photos of how the water flows through the system. And I should mention that the water flows by gravity. There is no pumping that is needed. The water is not stored. It's not recirculated anywhere in the system. So this top picture on the left shows the spring that makes up Influent 1. while this bottom picture here on the left shows the spring that makes up Influent 2. And the water from these two springs is combined and it flows into the four long raceways. And then at the bottom of the raceways, it's split and half goes into Settling Pond 1 and half goes into Settling Pond 2. And then the water flows by gravity through these concrete metal structures and into Hot Creek. So water from the third spring is captured here at Influent 3. It enters this long raceway and a hatchery building, which is just outside the picture. It flows through the raceway and hatchery building, and then it comes down to this pond here, and it exits through that metal box over here to Hot Creek. And finally, these photos here show the fourth spring. The spring is behind this metal fence. The spring is covered with a plastic material in an effort to reduce the growth of algae and other aquatic plants in it. So water from that spring flows through this raceway, through a hatchery building, and then into this very small tributary to Hot Creek. The discharger is currently regulated by a permit adopted in 2006. Both Water Board staff and the discharger acknowledge that there are significant problems with the effluent limits. The first problem is the flow limit. So as I've mentioned, the water supply from the hatchery comes from four springs. The flow from each spring varies seasonally and yearly as a function of rain and snow. The 2006 permit had four different flow limits, one for each of the four discharge points. But unfortunately, these limits were based on the spring's average flows, and the discharger cannot meet the flow limits because it does not control the volume of water flowing out of the springs, nor does it control the volume of water flowing out of the hatchery. The second problem is with the nitrate plus nitrite limit. The concentration of nitrate plus nitrite in the influent springs is usually higher than the effluent limit, so it's not possible for the discharger to comply with the effluent limit. The board acknowledged these problems with the 2006 permit and issued time schedule orders in 2009, 2010, and 2014. These TSOs included interim effluent limits for flow and nitrate plus nitrite and required additional monitoring. The TSOs also provided protection from mandatory minimum penalties as long as the discharger met the interim limits. The third TSO expired in May 2019, and the discharger is currently accruing mandatory minimum penalties for violations of the flow and nitrate plus nitrite limits. So this renewal addresses the problems with the 2006 permit. The flow limit has been removed, and the nitrate plus nitrate limit has been removed and replaced with a total nitrogen effluent limit. This is because fish hatchery waste contains various forms of nitrogen, and we think that total nitrogen is the most appropriate way to measure potential impacts. To set the limit, we use the Basin Plan's water quality objective for total nitrogen in Hot Creek, which is 1.5 milligrams per liter as an annual average. The fourth change clarifies the total suspended solids effluent limit. The 2006 permit recognized that the influent springs contain algae and aquatic plants, which contribute to the TSS and the effluent. And so that permit contained a net over influent limit. However, this limit was written in such a confusing manner that it's hard to enforce. So we've clarified the language and made it consistent throughout the permit. The fifth change is with the pH effluent limit. In the 2006 permit, the pH limit was 6.0 to 9.0, but that limit did not incorporate the Basin Plan's water quality objective for pH. So the proposed order mimics the Basin Plan with a pH limit of 6.5 to 8.5. However, the discharger asked us to consider the fact that the pH of the springs can be naturally less than 6.5, or naturally higher than 8.5. So we adjusted the limit to state that if the pH of an influent spring exceeds 8.5, then the pH of the corresponding effluent can be no more than 0.5 of a pH unit more than the influent.
So for example, if influent one has a pH of 8.6, then the limit for effluent one is 9.1. And there's a similar 0.5 pH allowance if the pH of the influent is less than 6.5. This pH limit is consistent with other recent hatchery permits adopted by the board. The sixth change was to adjust the effluent limit for potassium permanganate. During development of the proposed order, we found that the 2006 permit used an incorrect value for the 96-hour toxicity test, which was then used to calculate the effluent limit. In the tentative order, we used the correct value for the 96-hour toxicity test, and that resulted in significantly lower effluent limitations. However, after issuance of the tentative, the discharger provided information about the use of potassium permanganate and the various toxicity tests which have been conducted on this chemical. Because potassium permanganate is used at the hatchery for a treatment period of 1 hour or less, staff agreed that it's more appropriate to use the shortest toxicity test available, which is the 2 hour test, to calculate the effluent limit. The table on the slide here shows the effluent limits, comparing what was in the 2006 permit versus the tentative versus this proposed order. As you can see, the effluent limit in the proposed order is slightly lower than what was in the 2006 permit, but monitoring data shows that the discharger should be able to meet the suggested limit. The seventh change is to allow the discharger the option of operating settling ponds 1 and 2 or settling ponds 1, 2, and 3 in series, thereby eliminating either one or two discharge points. Reducing the number of discharge points will not only reduce monitoring costs, but will also reduce the possibility of effluent violations and the potential for mandatory minimum penalties. And the eighth change was to simplify the overall monitoring program by reducing the number of constituents and by allowing the discharger to submit USGS flow measurements instead of duplicating the work themselves. So we're also asking the board to adopt a time schedule order to accompany the renewed permit. The TSO is needed because the discharger will be unable to consistently comply with the new total nitrogen limit, in part because the influent springs contain total nitrogen at concentrations that exceed the effluent limit. The renewed permit's total nitrogen limit is 0.3 milligrams per liter, which is the basin plan's water quality objective for Hot Creek. The TSO's interim limit is 1.5 milligrams per liter, which is the basin plan's 90th percentile water quality objective for Hot Creek. Data shows that the discharger should be able to meet this interim limit. The TSO provides protection from mandatory minimum penalties as long as the discharger complies with the interim limit. In addition, the TSO requires that the discharger complete studies and propose a method to comply with the total nitrogen limit. So I'll now describe the items required by the TSO. So as I mentioned earlier, domestic wastewater from the hatchery is discharged to four percolation evaporation ponds that are upslope of two of the springs. These ponds have never been regulated by the Water Board, and the first requirement is that the discharger submit a report of waste discharge to enroll the ponds under the Board's general WDRs for limited domestic wastewater systems. The second component of the TSO is that the discharger investigate whether these wastewater ponds are contributing to the nitrogen in the springs. A groundwater monitoring well installation work plan is due by August of this year, and the wells must be installed about a year later by the fourth quarter of 2022. Now, normally we wouldn't agree to such a long time between a well installation work plan and when the wells are installed, but the discharger needs this time to coordinate the well locations with the two landowners, the Forest Service and LADWP. The TSO requires that the wells be monitored quarterly for 2 years, and then the discharger will submit a report evaluating whether the wastewater ponds are adversely impacting groundwater, and if so, they'll propose mitigation measures. So regardless of what happens with the wastewater ponds, it probably won't be enough to reduce the total nitrogen in the springs to concentrations that are below the effluent limit. Therefore, the third component of the TSO requires an evaluation of long-term solutions to the total nitrogen limit. By February 1st, 2023, the discharger will need to tell us whether it wishes to apply for a dilution credit and associated mixing zone, or whether it wishes to apply for a water quality variance. The discharger would then complete the studies needed for either option over the next 2 years. Ideally, the discharger would be consulting with water board staff throughout this process. The TSO would be in effect for 5 years, which is the maximum allowed by the Water Code, and the discharger would be expected to comply with the final total nitrogen limit when the TSO expires in March of 2026. The discharger is concerned about this final date because even though there is a year between when the studies are due and when the TSO expires, this may not be enough time for water board staff to complete the permitting process for the dilution credit or water quality variance. However, the Water Code does allow a time schedule order to be extended for an additional 5 years, and staff could propose a new TSO to allow additional time to finish the regulatory process for a long-term solution. We received comments on the tentative order from three parties. The discharger provided extensive comments on both the permit and the TSO, and staff had numerous meetings with Fish and Wildlife to understand and resolve the issues. I believe we've addressed all of the discharger's comments, either through changes or explanations as to why we couldn't make the changes. The Mammoth Community Water District submitted comments about the TSO. They're involved because they discharge treated domestic wastewater to Laurel Pond, which is upgradient of the Hot Creek Hatchery. Discharges from Laurel Pond may be contributing to the nitrogen levels in the hatchery springs. The Water District had two concerns about the language in the TSO, and we were able to revise the text to address those concerns. Our third set of comments were from the LA Department of Water and Power. They were concerned about the TSO's requirement to install groundwater monitoring wells around the wastewater ponds, and they suggested that other methods could be used to determine if the ponds were impacting groundwater. They also said that if wells must be installed, then more time should be allowed for the discharger to coordinate the well locations with them. We responded that monitoring wells are the industry standard for determining groundwater impacts, and therefore we would not change the requirement to install wells. But we would extend the date for the well installation report to allow coordination between the landowners and the discharger. We understand that LADWP is satisfied with this response. We believe that the permit and the TSO are now uncontested. So in summary, staff recommend that the board adopt the renewal of the NPDES permit and adopt a new time schedule order for the Hot Creek Fish Hatchery. This ends my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let me see if there are any questions from board members, starting with board member Cox.
There, sorry, I had a pop-up come up. Wendy, thank you for your involvement in this, your thoroughness, your identifying an issue and helping us as a region to address it more timely. As you were showing the photographs of the discharge going into Hot Creek, has there been any discussion or would there be any benefit running this discharge through some vegetative swales to help, you know, remediate some of the water quality impacts, or is that kind of outside the purview of this conversation?
You know, we did not discuss that with Fish and Wildlife, but the settling ponds that they use for the three of the discharges, that does help settle out any solids and any nitrogen associated with that. So that's basically their treatment right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's all I had, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Diaz?
Yes, thank you. Wendy, it appears that LADWP was hesitant to have monitoring wells installed. Do you know why?
I don't know why. And their comment letter kind of said two things. First, they said they didn't want wells, but if wells were needed, then they just wanted more time to discuss the locations. I don't know why.
Will the wells be located on LADWP property?
You know, we don't know. And Terry Jackson or someone from Fish and Wildlife might want to speak to this, but the last I heard is Fish and Wildlife was thinking of providing several well installation locations, several options that the board could look at and review. And then with those multiple options, they could then go back to the landowners to get permission.
Okay, thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Dr. Horn?
Yes, thank you. I have two questions. Can we have slide number 3 up again? That's the first question. Who's in charge of that?
Not me. Bob, can you do that?
It's the high-level view of the fish hatchery. Well, while we're waiting, I'll ask my second question, which had to do with the... Oh, here it is. Yay. Okay. Simple question. can you point out where Laurel Pond is?
Yeah, do I still have control? Okay. So Laurel Pond is on the other side of 395. It's that'd be the west side of 395, and it's just...
Can you put a little cursor on it? Because there are several different potential blues.
Do I have control of the cursor again?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Can you see my cursor?
Yeah.
I'm circling?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's like right about where the circle is, like in the west of 395, kind of this area here.
Where the cursor that's moving around is off the map, so.
That's not my cursor.
I don't.
Oh, how about where it says lakes? Are you guys giving me that again?
Oh, there we go.
Okay, you guys still have control of the pointer.
No. I wanted slide 3.
Bob, I don't have control.
All right. I'll ask my other question while we're sorting this out. I always like to get a sort of visual understanding of the hydrology of an area that we're looking at. All right. Let's see if we can do it now.
So if you see the S on Mammoth Lakes.
The bold, large print Mammoth Lakes?
Yeah, then just below that, there's the smaller Mammoth Lakes that's pretty faint.
Yeah.
It's kind of in that area right there.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Wow. A lot of work for simple. all right, so my second question, I just wanted to understand more clearly about how the settling ponds were to be combined for monitoring.
Oh, yeah.
So when I went back and read in the actual permit, it looked to me like it may occur if, Fish and Wildlife chooses to actually physically combine the ponds, as opposed to, I was wondering if you were going to take samples from each of them and then combine them all in one sample and just monitor that.
Could we go to the next slide and then I could show you maybe a little better?
Okay.
So if you see where it says effluent 1 and 2, so those two ponds are very close to each other, and there's actually already a pipe in the berm between the two ponds. So Fish and Wildlife could block off the effluent 1 discharge point and allow water to flow from pond one to two and then out. And then out into Hot Creek. So right now, under the current permit, they couldn't do that currently. They're not allowed to under the current permit. So this permit, if you adopt it, allows them to do that if they choose. And then they would only have to monitor from the effluent two point because effluent one would no longer be used.
All right. So it would reduce the monitoring locations from four to three. Is that right?
Right. And then we also, and that sounds like it's more likely that they will do that. The other option in the permit was to allow them to flow from pond one into pond two, into pond three, and then just discharge from pond three. Oh. But they don't think, at least from what I've heard, they don't think there's enough capacity in the system to allow those flows to happen. But we gave it to them in case in the future they choose to do that.
Okay, thank you. Now I understand. That's all.
Thank you. Mr. Jardine?
Board Chair, I no longer see Board Member Jardine in the system. Katrina will reach out and see if he's experiencing some technical difficulties.
Thank you. I'll go to Mr. Sandell.
Thank you. Referring to slide 13, I don't quite grasp why the MPDES final limit at 0.3 is lower than the TSO interim limit at 1.5. Maybe you could explain that point to me.
So the water quality objective for Hot Creek for total nitrogen is 0.3. And that's what the permit has for an effluent limit. The basin plan also has a 90th percentile water quality objective of 1.5 for total nitrogen. And that's what we're using for the interim effluent limit.
And there's no conflict between having those two different limits. They both are annual averages, but the fact that they're different numbers is not an issue.
Yeah, they're both measured as annual averages. And that's basically what a time schedule order does, is it gives a discharger a slightly higher effluent limit for a set period of time while they're doing studies or doing what they need to do to come into compliance with the final limit in the permit.
Okay. So at some point, would this be adjusted so that it would no longer require the time schedule order 1.5 and it would go back to 0.3, or would something in between, or what would happen eventually?
So in a perfect world, and with the other time schedule orders that I was familiar with when I worked at Region 5, a discharger would do whatever construction or modifications were needed of, say, their wastewater plant in order to meet the final limit within their permit. This system is very unusual because those influent springs have nitrogen at a pretty high level already. Right. They've got nitrogen at levels that exceed their effluent limit.
Yes.
So in this case, that's why the time schedule order has the discharger evaluate whether it wants to apply for a water quality variance or a dilution zone and mixing study. And, you know, it may be long-term that a basin plan amendment is needed.
Yep.
But we can't actually write that into a time schedule order. The time schedule order has to end at the five-year period with you're going back into compliance with your permit. That's just the way the water code is written.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I think I understand at least better now. Thank you. I can't thank you enough for making this whole permit finally make sense overall. I have never seen it make sense until today, basically.
Okay.
So thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Sandell. I have no questions. It was an excellent presentation, and also the material that was in our package was excellently done. I truly appreciate your work.
Thank you.
The call for a presentation by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Mr. Jackson. Are you going to go first? I'm not sure what order folks are going in.
Mr. Chairman, this is Scott Ferguson with the Lahontan Water Board. I believe Leslie McNair is scheduled to go first.
That's perfect.
And any of the CDFW representatives, if before you speak, can you introduce yourself as well as a state whether or not you've taken the oath? Thank you.
Yes, this is Leslie McNair. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Leslie McNair, and I have taken the oath. And I am the regional manager for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Inland Deserts region, which includes Mono, Inyo, San Bernardino, Riverside, and Imperial counties. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding this agenda item. First, I would like to thank the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board staff, including Wendy Wiles, Rob Tucker, and Trevor Miller. Your staff have been extremely responsive and receptive to comments and helpful with this process. The Department of Fish and Wildlife is pleased to have a new tentative permit and associated TSO on today's board agenda, as this has been a long time coming. I know this has been a large workload to prepare the tentative permit and the TSO and coordinate with our respective staff members. I've been in contact with Mike Plasiak, and he agrees that after this tentative permit and TSO are adopted, our agencies need to work together on a long-term solution for Hot Creek Hatchery. We have discussed options such as a basin plan amendment, the variance process, and the possibility of designating Hot Creek Springs as a headwaters with its own water quality objectives. Whichever option is decided as the best approach, I am committed to dedicating staff to help this process and to provide data and scientific support. Now, Terry Jackson, our statewide NPDES coordinator, will speak to several specific ongoing long-term concerns that the Department of Fish and Wildlife has related to the basin plan and the tentative permit and the TSO for Hot Creek Hatchery. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Terry Jackson. I am the statewide NPDES coordinator for California Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have taken the oath as well. Thank you, Leslie, for that. And it's nice to be before most of you again, although I don't even know if you can see me or whatever, but I have been before you in the past. And so it's good to see some of you again. I wish we were in person, but oh well. But it's been a lot of years, and it's interesting. This is a position where I often operate, it seems like, above my pay grade. So I work with people. In fact, I've had the pleasure of, the candid cooperation. I thank Mike Plasiak. He's even called me at home after hours on certain crises and stuff like that. And, and poor Wendy, she probably didn't know what she got herself into when she said yes to this. But it's been a real appreciation to work with Wendy and Rob and Trevor in particular, Scott Ferguson as well, in various aspects. We just really appreciate that we've made a long way on this. This is actually a great day as far as I'm concerned. When I took this position a decade ago, I actually didn't plan on being here this long, but one of the very first things they told me was Hot Creek was a priority for me to get a new permit. It's possibly it is indeed the most complex system. I deal with about 26 hatcheries for the state. This is by far the most complex and diverse facility. It's kind of interesting to be here. I've been here with the state for 28 years. I actually did a study when I was a consultant in the 90s. I did the hydraulic modeling and fish habitat evaluation of Mammoth Creek for the Mammoth County Water District. And so it's kind of interesting to be back working on this. I don't know who's in charge of the slide thing. I put together a slide. My intention of this slide presentation is to kind of give you an overview. Wendy did a tremendous job of showing how the hatchery works. My goal here is to kind of give you guys a quick overview Leslie mentioned that coordinating with Mike Plesiak that, you know, there is some concerns over the basin plan issues, and that's really where we are as a department is, you know, we're looking forward, but glad to be here finally. But mostly we know that most of the staff we've been working with, what sounds like we'll be shifting over to the basin planning unit and spending some time working with them to correct some of the stuff. So if I could have the next slide, I presume that's the way to do this. I just asked for the next slide. So as you can see, Mammoth, if you've never been to Hot Creek, it's absolutely stunning. It's a beautiful place. But next slide, please. It goes from beautiful to a whole different atmosphere quickly. There's tremendous seasonal changes that we have to deal with, as well as annual changes that come with whether it be a wet, dry, or normal year, and whether or not we get snowpack, whether we get high flows or not. Not to mention, next slide. We also are tucked into a very diverse, huge, huge watershed. If you can see that the watershed starts up above Old Mammoth, flows all the way down past 395 through the hatchery. You can kind of see there's a cluster of markers I put in there, eventually flows. So you'll see down there the Hot Creek at County Road. That's where the basin plan objective, those where the water quality objectives are measured for Hot Creek, is clear down there about 4 miles downstream. And eventually it snakes through a bunch of geologic changes. In fact, there's geologic issues and geothermic. We have there's a mammoth geothermic complex right at 395. So it goes down eventually into Lake Crowley. Next slide, please. This is just kind of to zoom in to kind of give you a better overview of, again, the distance of where Hot Creek sits as Mammoth Creek kind of flows past it. And then it flows its way on down to the springs. You can see there kind of in the mid zone of Hot Creek between the hatchery and Hot Creek at County Road, you can see kind of a white area that is actually all Hot Creek springs. That's an area that the Forest Service takes care of. So there's a lot of geologic inflow that comes into the creek downstream of us. So I believe that's one of the reasons, if you look at the objectives, you'll see on every element, every parameter that's measured, minus nitrate and nitrogen, there is a huge jump in sulfate, huge jump in fluoride, boron, TDS. There's a huge jump because I believe there's a pretty drastic change in the water quality objectives, because the last place that it's measured is at Hot Creek, or at Mammoth Creek at 395, and then again measured all the way down here. And so if you look at the numbers in the table, which I'll show you a little bit later, there's a pretty big jump. So that's one of the reasons we would like to have a discussion of the objectives in the past. Next slide, please. So this is just zooming in a little more. This is, you saw this with Wendy's slide, although I did capture, you can see where the percolation evaporation ponds actually lie in comparison to the hatchery. You can see then each of the locations that we're required to monitor. And you can kind of see that along each of these springs, you can see lots of green. That's kind of gives you an indication of how much natural spring activity goes on throughout this whole property. There's also one area, and I'll zoom in on it here in a second, but you can see we mentioned the Hot Creek Springs. It's kind of a zone right below the settling ponds that Wendy was mentioning, and before the confluence of Mammoth Creeks and Hot Creeks. And that's a kind of a unique area that I'll mention here. But you can see all the way down, you can see Hot Creek Ranch is just below where our effluent four feeds into Hot Creek. So there's kind of a lot going on in this area. Next slide, please. So again, zooming in, this is just to give you a little better view of the ponds. There are four of them there. We have an MOU with the Forest Service for those ponds to operate there. We typically only use one of the four ponds at a time, as where it is near correct. And we believe that, you know, the ponds are to the east of our influent one and influent two. So we don't believe that they will. Obviously, the monitoring wells will give us an indication of that, but we don't anticipate that they affect those two springs at all. We'll see what they do regarding springs 3 and 4. Next slide, please. And so then this zooms in a little better so you can see kind of the bottom end of our facility. And there you can see a little better what I was talking about, the Hot Creek Springs section. There's that zone of Hot Creek Springs before it connects in with a totally hydro, a different system as far as we don't get flushing flows. We don't get the snow melt per se out of the Mammoth Mountains, et cetera. And then, of course, you can see the complex, especially if you look, I believe it was Ms. Horn asked about filtration of the water. So there is a lot of, it's hard to see from this, there is a lot of grasses and stuff that grow in Hot Creek, and especially below effluent 4, it's a huge grassy, almost like a slow-moving marsh flow, depending on the flows in the creek. So, and then we are receiving water too, which is where we measure down there. You can see that we measure just below effluent 4, but we have to not go down too far because that whole zone there upstream of Hot Creek Ranch is another natural spring pouring in a bunch of water. So we didn't want to, you know, add additional water to measure. So next slide, please. So one of the concerns we have, as I mentioned, is a lot of flow. And so this is a letter that, so we've had this concern since 2006. You know, we mentioned that we received the original MPDS back in June of 2006. We're really grateful that this limitation has been removed from this particular permit. Within a couple months, the manager at Hot Creek back then wrote a letter to the board saying, you know, hey, we cannot meet this. This is, you know, we don't have control of the flows. And so, unfortunately, even though we sent a letter in September of 2006, it took until May of 2009 before you know, we had a TSO that stopped the process of MMPs getting violations for flows that we had no control of. And that's just a concern that we have, that, you know, Wendy mentioned that we do have a concern of the TSO issue, is that we are at the mercy of the permit. If a TSO is not renewed, if the water board doesn't renew, we revert to a TSO and we're caught with fines that we're not at all in control of. In the case of this one, is the flow. And then, of course, we had Wendy mentioned the issue of the nitrates and the nitrogen levels coming out of our springs. We're not in control of that as well, at least for springs 1 and 2. We'll see what the results are with the ponds. So again, it was an issue. And so to give you a kind of an idea, because we are with this, it's our second permit and essentially third or fourth TSO since 2006. You know, we just are concerned that we finally get to a permanent solution instead of keep kicking the can down the road. And that's where we're looking forward to working with the basin plan unit to come up with a good plan. We've been very busy with, you know, taking care of a lot of things. And so if you move to the next slide, I'll kind of give you a quick show as I zoom in. So these are a couple of the raceways. This is Long Spring number 3 that flows down. And so I'm going to zoom in. Next slide. You can see the flows coming in. That's water that's flowing in that we don't take account for. This is how much the spring flow could be. Next slide, please. You can see that it just kind of flows into the system that is downstream. So again, we didn't have any control of this. Next slide, please. So in an effort, as you said, Wendy mentioned we were required to do several studies. One of the studies that we did was a bioassessment. Since 2009, the department has invested roughly $1.2 million into with the studies of TSO and cleaning out settling ponds and all the water quality monitoring. So we've had a huge investment of trying to understand this hatchery, trying to meet the previous permit and TSOs. And so one of the studies that we did was a bioassessment. That's to evaluate the aquatic insects in the system. They're usually a pretty good indicator of water quality if different things are going on. You'll see that we had sites up in Mammoth Creek. Those are the red ones, and on down into Hot Creek. But also, if you notice, and I'll show something specific again in the Hot Creek Springs, the two dark blue dots there below the effluents. Those, again, it's one of our reasons that we've suggested that possibly the hatchery should have its own basin plan, its own objectives, rather than dealing with Mammoth Creek, Hot Creek. But I'll share with that in a second. So here, next couple of slides. Next slide is show, just kind of give you an idea of what they do. So this one here is evaluating where the people are out collecting data on the quality of the data, the quality of the habitat. Next slide. They collect a lot of insects that they're going to sort through and in each section to identify and get an estimate of what that means. Next slide, please. Also measure the physical habitat as far as area. So they also put that into an equation. You can see there's Hot Creek Ranch just below one of our sites. Next slide. This is, gives you an indication. This is what it looks like as effluent four. You can see up above is our hatchery building, and effluent four flows down through this grassy area before it eventually, this is the confluence of effluent four tributary flowing into Hot Creek. And next slide. And just below this location is part of that. I was telling you that the springs start flowing in out of nowhere. You can see just up the hill is sagebrush, and then it quickly transitions into a lush green as the spring water just flows out of the side of the hills. Next slide, please. And then this is the data. This is just a rough scatter plot of the that's in one of the attachments that we sent with comments. But this is as we did the bioassessment. And you can see, so the yellow dots are what we collected data in 2009. So you can, one of the things you'll see is that 2017, and then we didn't do 18, but and then 19 are pretty high. And those are both wet years compared to 15 and 16, which were drought years. And so there's something obviously that goes on. But one thing that's really curious, and that's why we, again, we're looking at maybe the Hot Creek Springs themselves, the blue clustering right there, including 2019, which is a very wet, was a wet year. The clusterings of the aquatic assessment all stay together because, again, that spring flow, we don't see a flushing flow like we do from Hot Creek and Mammoth Creek of the spring melt. And so, again, this is just some data to share with you guys to consider as we next slide, please. So we also mentioned settling ponds. So the settling pond is kind of a zoom in as we have, this was before we had them dredged. Depending on which way the wind is blowing, it depends on what our TSS may be doing. We do have lots of algae that comes in through the system from the springs. And we had a lot of settling. These ponds are tremendous for settling out the solids, but and the algae does grow as well as macrophytes. Next slide, please. So in an effort to clean this out, we also have the endangered tui chub. Owen's tui chub lives in our ponds. And so it's both state and federally listed. We had to coordinate with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as the U.S. Forest Service to be able to collect the fish out of there before we drain the ponds. We needed to be able to salvage them. Next slide, please. We did all this back in starting in the end of September, or September 2014 was when we did this. This is a quick shot, underwater shot of the tui chubs. They hold still about as good as infants when you're trying to take their picture. Next slide, please. So we started the process of draining. You can see as we're taking that down. Next slide, please. And then eventually we got down to where we were getting to the sediment. This is a mostly fish poop and extra stuff that's been settled into our ponds. Next slide, please. We worked very long hours to try and get this done as quickly as possible so that we weren't offline. We could also get the chubs back into their habitat as quickly as possible. Next slide, please. some very large equipment, getting down to the base and get the sludge out of the system. Next slide, please. This is a shot of a chub. Next slide. We then were able to return the chubs in December and November. We were able to return them back into the ponds, into their habitats, with the cooperation of Fish and Wildlife and Forest Service. Next slide. And this is what the cleaned up product looked like. It was a much, you know, nice clean pond. And so we anticipate these ponds to stay clean. It takes about 20 years to build up that amount of sediment again. So we try to monitor the depth of the sediment so that we're in good shape for a while. Next slide, please. Regarding the percolation ponds, these are just a couple of shots. There's, like I said, three of the ponds are dry. Next slide. Next slide. And then the fourth pond, typically northeast pond. It looks like this is kind of like a marsh. It's about 4 to 6 inches of water in the pond itself. A lot of grass growing in there. So these are the ponds that that we've been asked to put monitoring wells in around. We're not sure. We know that for sure they'll provide us good data. I don't know that they'll answer the question, regarding the basin plan question. We're believing that, that one of the biggest issues, which is the next slide, is the water quality objective. So you can see I've circled in there. These are the main areas, the little red area, numbers 3 through 8 are what pertain to Mammoth Creek and Hawk Creek. And you can see in every constituent that's measured that there's a higher number and a big jump when you get down to the Hawk Creek at County Road. There's a big jump for each of those constituents. But interestingly, for some reason, total nitrogen drops to 0.3, which is half of what the upstream is, yet the and then even so. So it's kind of curious. We're believing that there must be something. You know, we don't know where this data came from. I don't even know how long ago this was established, but this is part we will talk about in the future. Next slide, please. This gives you a quick indication of how many sampling sites we did have. Yes, we're looking forward to reducing the number of sampling. This is how much sampling we were doing from 2009 on to comply with the TSO. So we have a lot of data on a lot of constituents on everything that was flowing into this very complex system. Next slide, please. And this is the last kind of a wrap up on total nitrogen. I pulled out the data that we had collected from 2014 through 2019 that was provided in by the permit as well. You can see that the 0.3 milligram per liter, we can't hit that. Even in springs 1 and 2, although the last couple of years seems to be a little bit lower. Interestingly, it's very, annually something happened in 2017. Again, I think that was a first wet year coming off of a couple of years of drought. So something obviously happens when water starts getting injected back into the springs. There was a huge jump. We're hoping that we would be closer to 0.6 or maybe 0.7, but it just gives you an indication of how complex things are, and just even in the springs themselves. Next slide, please. It gets even more complex when you add the effluent. There's all kinds of stuff between annual variation, depending on, I guess, water years or whatever else going on that we have to tease out of there. To try and knock the noise out, next slide, basically the last slide, I tried to knock the slide, and I took the annual average. So I did the average of the 5 years on an annual average to just kind of show, if you were to look at it over in this particular case, a 5 year period, we still would never meet the 0.3. But we maybe could meet the 0.6. But I guess we'll see where that is. So whether or not we in the basin planning process look at the basin plan that we currently are under, or whether we look at establishing separate limits for the Hot Creek Springs themselves, I guess that is yet to be determined as we work forward with the water board. So we just, the main thing we ask is that we could get a commitment by the water board that, and as Wendy said, being in coordination, and we no doubt will be in coordination a lot in the next 5+ years to, on everything, just trying to figure everything out and get an answer to this so we can finally, you know, just move forward. So next slide. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time, and any questions, I'd be glad to help.
Let's see if we have any questions from board members, starting with Ms. Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just, your slides really show us how beautiful this area is, and that you're protecting the environment in ways that you can. I'm glad we can partner with you in helping you meet the water quality parameters that are within our purview. And I just think it's such an important job that you do in these fish hatcheries. So thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Dias?
No questions, but also I'd like to thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.
Dr. Horn?
Yes, I have no questions for Mr. Jackson. Just my comment is thank you for sharing such beautiful pictures with us and giving us a chance to visit the Hot Creek area virtually. It's really a stunning place. I have another question for Wendy Wiles, when it's appropriate time to ask that question.
I don't know that it's inappropriate now. If it is, I'm sure Ms. Barrett will tell me, but otherwise, now would be fine.
All right. So I was just wondering why we couldn't do something with the total nitrogen similar to what was done with the TSS to have the requirement to be net over influent as opposed to a solid number.
I'm going to take a stab at this, and Rob will probably have to correct me, but my understanding is there is a water quality objective for nitrogen, total nitrogen or nitrate. There is no water quality objective for TSS, so I think there's a little more flexibility there.
So do we have to have a water quality objective at this specific site for total nitrogen?
Hey, hi, this is Rob Tucker, and I have taken the oath. To jump in on that, for NPDES permits, if you have a water quality objective, which we do, we have to insert that, or we're required to insert that as part of the NPDES permit. We exceed that water quality objective due to all the discharges and the natural flows currently. So not having it in there, we would probably receive comments from a number of EPA when they do their reviews, like, why haven't you included that? You have a water quality objective. And that's why we did the TSO.
Well, okay, but I still don't understand why we can't do a basin plan amendment to remove the water quality objective for this particular site.
That is doable, and it's fallen below the line on the triennial review for the past 9 years.
Okay. All right, that's my question.
Mr. Jardine?
Mr. Jardine is still not on the Zoom platform.
Thank you. Will you just let me know when he comes back, and then I'll be a little more clued in to what we're doing. Thanks. I appreciate that a lot. Mr. Sandell?
Yes, thank you. I was very interested to see the pictures and the presentation from Terry Jackson. Thanks for all of that. And I'm looking forward to our beginning or continuing work on basin plan amendments and all that to bring this to its final state in the next 5 years or whatever. That'll be nice. But where we are now is such a vast improvement. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. McNair and Mr. Jackson, and thanks for your thoughts, Dr. Horn. We are a lot further down the road than we were, and we're still caught in a really complicated situation, but it sounds at least like there are some potential pathways that we could take to get to a more solid set of ground. I've spent an awful lot of time at Hot Creek and down below the hatchery, and it's a marvelous place of varied habitat and rich value. Never occurs to me when I'm down there that all of the complexities that make it so special are headaches to somebody else and they're having to do the jobs that they have to do. It's a lesson in perspective, I guess, and it was well communicated by Mr. Jackson. I appreciate that. I also have a speaker card from Heidi Calvert.
Hi, Pete. She's just here in case anybody has questions.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. If there are no other presentations from anyone from the public or nothing further from either our staff or the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm going to pause to make sure there isn't.
There's nobody in the queue with their hand raised.
Thank you. I'm going to then close this hearing and open the process to discussion and voting by the board. Again, I would remind you that we're going to take the two items separately, the first being the permit, and then the second being the TSO. So why don't we start with focus on the NPDES permit itself.
I would like to move that we approve renewal of the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit.
I'll be very pleased to second that.
While I have the floor, I would like to make some comments, if I may. First of all, I mean, I'm just echoing what Mr. Sandell has said. I have always hated imposing minimum mandatory penalties on this hatchery when we were imposing them for things over which the hatchery had no control. It made no sense to me that we're imposing penalties for water quality and water flow that would be there regardless of whether the hatchery was there or not. So as Mr. Sandell said, we're getting much closer to a reasonable solution here. And compliment the staff on the diligence and really digging into the issues and understanding the hydrology here and identifying other potential sources or responsible parties that could be contributing to the high nitrogen levels in the water that flows into the hatchery and the creative use of the TSO, which is coming later, I know, but that the requiring the investigations and the studies that would make it possible to really figure out if there's really a nitrogen problem here or not, and if so, who might be responsible for that problem, and hopefully the next time around we can bring this to a final conclusion. And I would ask staff to make it a priority to renew the TSO, and that's coming later, I know, when the time is appropriate, so that no more MMPs are imposed on the Department of Fish and Wildlife for things over which they have no control. That's just not fair.
It's been moved and seconded. Any comments or discussions, Ms. Cox?
No comments.
Mr. Diaz?
No comment.
Anything further, Dr. Horn?
I think I've had my say.
Mr. Sandell?
And me also. No, let's move to the vote.
Okay, then I won't have any comments either. Ms. Cox?
Aye.
Mr. Diaz.
Aye.
Dr. Horn.
Aye.
Mr. Sandell.
An enthusiastic aye.
I vote aye as well. Secondly, then, the question of the time schedule order.
I move that we pass the time schedule order as presented by staff.
I'll second the motion.
Been moved and seconded. A call for comments or any discussion, Ms. Cox?
No comments, thank you.
Mr. Diaz?
No comments or discussion, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
I'm ready to vote.
Mr. Sandell, I bet I know you.
Yes, indeed.
call for a vote, Ms. Cox?
Aye.
Mr. Diaz?
Aye.
Dr. Horn?
Aye.
Mr. Sandell?
Aye.
Aye also. Thank you all. Thanks greatly. Thanks to everybody who participated in this. Ms. Wiles, gosh,
especially.
Very, very much. You must have come to the meeting on a white charger because you certainly have been of great, great benefit to us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, if we were meeting in person, we'd take her to dinner.
We would. Thank you. Item 8 on the agenda is climate change mitigation and adaptation plan, action plan.
Yes, Board Chair, that will be presented by Lori Screed.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to pause a minute here. I think Ben is going to open the item.
Yeah, well, can we get the presentation, please? Item 8. Okay, how's my audio? I didn't do an audio check.
Sounds good.
Perfect.
Good afternoon, Chair Pomfrey, members of the board. My name is Ben Letton. I'm a division manager in your South Lake Tahoe office of the Lahontan Water Board. And I'm also currently the acting AEO for the region. I have taken the oath. This afternoon, Senior Environmental Scientist Lori Screed will be presenting item 8 in your agenda packet, starting on bait stamp 8-1. Before Lori gets started with the presentation, I want to say a few words about this item by providing some background and context for where we are in this climate change adaptation mitigation strategy and action plan development journey, and also provide some well-deserved acknowledgement and recognition for those that I have that have worked so hard on this effort. Also, I'd like to more formally introduce Lori as the Regional Monitoring Coordinator and lead for facilitating our climate change strategy and action planning efforts. Lori previously worked in our forestry dredge and fill unit, and before that worked at Leviathan Mine. She brings 2 decades of experience working with the Water Board to this position, and we are very thankful to have her in this role. Previously, Mary Fiore Wagner held this position, the Regional Monitoring Coordinator. And as you may recall, Mary promoted to a supervisor of the non-point source unit in March of 2020. And the Regional Monitoring Coordinator position remained vacant for many months due to the COVID pandemic and resultant hiring freeze. We were able to fill that position in early November, and Lori has worked diligently since that time developing the Climate Change Action Plan framework that is described in detail in the staff report in your packet, starting on page stamp 8-7. The Climate Change Adaptation and Mitigation Strategy resolution that you adopted in November 2019 directed staff to prepare an action plan to define specific work priorities and actions to be integrated into our regulatory and planning efforts. However, what it did not do was provide specific directions or guidance on how we could most efficiently and effectively achieve that integration. I think we came to the realization that our climate change action plan needed detail in terms of how to achieve this integration because of a number of factors, which Lori will speak to in more detail during her presentation. And I want to point out that simultaneous to development of the action plan, we are also engaged in several efforts that have opened our eyes a bit in terms of how this action plan and a lot of our other work could be most effective and efficient. Namely, the organizational improvements that have been we have been engaged in since spring of 2020 through the development of our employee engagement action plan and the recognition that we need to improve the organization in four key areas: process, communication, leadership, and trust. We believe that the climate change action plan and framework that is in your packet today aligns well with at least two, possibly more, of those key areas, particularly process and communication. Another effort we have engaged in through a training program called Prioritize Leader, and we are learning a lot in that training program on how to prioritize our heavy workload. The Climate Change Adaptation and Mitigation Action Plan framework incorporates many of the strategies and techniques that we are learning about through that training program. So in summary, the action plan and the framework that we are bringing to you is intended to increase the efficacy of the Water Board's climate change response planning, reporting, and implementation by formalizing the approach Water Board staff will use to integrate climate change work planning and decision-making. Before I hand this off to Lori, I just want to thank everyone who has had a part in developing the climate change adaptation mitigation strategy and now this action plan framework. I'd like to start by acknowledging Mary Fiore Wagner, who was the staff lead for this effort for many years and did the lion's share of the work to get us to where we are today. I'd like to also recognize many program managers and line staff who helped to facilitate early stakeholder meetings and outreach. In particular, I'd like to acknowledge former AEO Doug Smith, who really got this effort going, and division manager Scott Ferguson, who helped manage this effort for about a year and a half at one point. Both did some heavy lifting in terms of coordinating board meeting items, staff reports, and stakeholder outreach. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge you, the Lahontan Water Board, who made development of this strategy and this action plan a regional priority. Thank you all for your hard work and dedication. It was a team effort. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Lori Scream.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning, Chair Pumphrey and members of the board. As Ben said, my name is Lori Scream. I am a senior environmental scientist specialist with the Lahontan Board. I've been here for quite a few years, and I work out of our South Lake Tahoe office. I'm presenting on item 8. This is an informational item on our newly created Climate Change Mitigation and Adaptation Action Plan. I have about 10 slides and expect the presentation will probably run for about 20 minutes. Next slide, please. So this is an outline of today's presentation. I'm going to start with a brief look at our prior regional board efforts on climate change, and then I'll walk through the sections of our action plan. There's four main sections of the action plan that we'll review. This includes a quick look at the regional board's role in climate change mitigation and adaptation, then reviewing the policy statements that were adopted by the board in 2019. We'll then dive a little bit deeper into the action plan framework itself, looking at how we develop and prioritize actions, and finish with a description of our annual updates to the board. After that, we'll have a little bit of time for comments and questions, should anybody have them. Next slide, please. So as Ben mentioned, we've been working for numerous years here getting to the action plan, and Lahontan staff have taken several steps over the last 5 or 6 years to make progress in furthering the climate change goals of the state. We held numerous outreach meetings to gain input from stakeholders on the role of the Water Board and the potential actions we could take. Then we formed internal working groups to further refine the concepts proposed at these meetings. These efforts are all documented in a 2017 staff report that was presented to the board. And that staff report also summarized the state's climate change framework, critical climate change policies, and requirements for state agencies, including the water boards. The early public outreach and staff efforts ultimately led to the adoption of Resolution R60-2019-0277 and the Climate Change Mitigation and Adaptation Strategy. As we go through the presentation, I will refer to those as the resolution and the strategy, because that's a mouthful to say every time. So the strategy, it presents an overview of the expected climatic and water quality impacts from climate change to the Lahontan region, and it provides a strategic vision for leveraging both internal regional board actions and supporting the work of others. This is a critical piece of that and recognizes that we don't have additional or new resources to address climate change response. We have to integrate this into our existing resources. So the resolution and the strategy also formalized four policy statements to focus regional board efforts. And we'll go a little bit deeper into the policy statements in just a few more slides. So another piece, critical piece of the strategy, the climate change strategy, was direction to prepare an action plan that would describe specific actions the board staff would take towards climate change mitigation and adaptation. And the strategy directed that the plan should define specific priorities, efforts, and actions that should be integrated into our work planning. However, as Ben mentioned, neither the strategy nor the resolution provided specific direction or processes to achieve that integration. So the action plan that we're presenting today provides that additional direction and clarity that was needed to ensure progress in implementing the strategy. It formalizes the approach that staff will use to integrate into our work planning and decision making. Next slide, please. So when integrating climate change response into our work planning, it's important to acknowledge the Water Board's role as a regulatory agency in the context of potential actions that we can achieve. As a regulatory agency, we have policy, permitting, and enforcement tools that we can leverage to further the goals of building a sustainable water portfolio in Eastern California. We also conduct water quality monitoring and can require others to conduct various types of water quality related monitoring. So the left side of this figure in a little bit of yellow there, it provides some examples of internal actions that we can take as an agency. Part of the vision adopted in the strategy and supported by the action plan is that we will be most effective in protecting water quality and beneficial uses in the face of climate change by both directing internal Water Board resources towards actions that improve resiliency in the areas identified by the policy statements, and by supporting climate change adaptation and mitigation efforts undertaken by external agencies and organizations. The right side of this slide provide some examples of Water Board actions that support external efforts. And the middle of the diagram shows the overlap in those two roles. Internal actions that we can take include, you know, modifying permit requirements, utilizing our enforcement, requiring different types of assessments. We also have our surface water ambient monitoring program. And then we need to take all that data and that information, really utilize the data in decision making. We need to integrate climate science, and we'll support external efforts by being active partners and active collaborators as other agencies and entities take actions themselves. So the mission of the Water Boards to protect and restore surface and groundwater quality for current and future generations means inherently that much of our agency's work will support climate change adaptation and sustainable water resources. The Climate Change Action Plan on Base Stamp 813 in your packet provides a table with some examples of our ongoing program work that supports climate change mitigation and adaptation. I should mention that this figure is also contained in your staff report on Base Stamp page 812. in that it's not an exhaustive list, but it illustrates some of the roles that we play. So as I just mentioned, a lot of our ongoing program work will build water resiliency in Eastern California. Some examples of this include our site cleanup program activities that require the cleanup of polluted groundwater, issuing permits to control discharges to land, and supporting external efforts by writing letters of support for groups seeking funding for meadow restoration projects. These are all activities that will go on, driven by our programs. So I see our challenge, that our challenge is to apply the current climate science and projected environmental changes to our water resources and water quality, and then take a proactive approach to addressing these issues through focused use of our policy, permitting, monitoring, and enforcement tools. It's our duty to anticipate how climate change may impact water quality into the future, and to ensure that we are taking actions to fulfill our mission of protecting water resources for both existing and future generations. Next slide, please. So I mentioned the policy statements a few times. The policy statements were adopted in the resolution back in November 2019, and these describe areas that the Water Board will make progress on over the long term to promote greater levels of water quality protection and water resource resiliency in the face of climate change. The policy statements are described in greater detail in the strategy and summarized in the action plan. They will help provide focus to Water Board staff, managers, and executive management when developing and implementing specific actions. Just as a quick review, Policy Statement 1, the protection of wetlands, floodplains, and headwaters. This is meant to support internal and external actions that facilitate improved meadow, wetland, and floodplain conditions, as well as stream flows. Policy Statement 2, infrastructure protection. This supports actions to help build and maintain sustainably functioning infrastructure so that built systems are safe and reliable during extreme weather events such as heat waves, precipitation, severe droughts, and wildfires. And the type of infrastructure we'd initially be focusing on is water supply, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure. Policy Statement 3 is the protection of groundwater quality and supply. This policy statement supports actions to protect groundwater quality, improve groundwater recharge for purposes of protecting source water, and building sustainability and drought resiliency. Our last policy statement, number 4, is the protection of headwater forests and promoting fire resiliency. This statement supports actions to facilitate the pace and scale of projects implemented to build resilience of headwaters forests, including those actions that reduce vulnerability to catastrophic fires and pest infestations, and that support post-fire recovery efforts. So these policy statements will really help focus and guide our actions. They'll be used as part of the action plan framework to filter and refine potential actions that we can take. And those actions that support the policy statements will be moved forward for further consideration. Next slide, please. So as mentioned earlier in this presentation, this climate change action plan establishes a strong link between the climate change strategy and our annual work planning efforts that implement our various programs. The action plan really focuses on our internal processes and provides a framework and direction for how climate change actions are developed, implemented, and reported. So the intent is for program staff, program managers, supervisors, executives to use this framework as a roadmap to develop, prioritize, implement, and report on actions, and to understand how communication should occur within the organization. This direction will ensure that the climate change actions and action planning remain a focus during our annual work planning. The framework has three main parts that are guided by the policy statements and guidance within the strategy. The first is the development and cataloging of potential actions that we can take, then prioritizing and implementing those actions through annual work planning, and last but certainly not least, clarification on our internal communication and coordination. The next few slides will go further into each of these parts that are essential for integrating climate change into our programs and work planning. Next slide, please. So as shown on this slide, there are multiple inputs for generating potential actions that the board may take. The blue icons represent ongoing meetings or processes that will generate ideas. These include program roundtables, triennial review, quarterly climate change meetings between the regional board and state board divisions. We also have partnerships outreach and emerging issues. Then the green box at the bottom is meant to reflect more of a one-time effort to catalog the potential actions that were developed through our early stakeholder outreach and our internal working groups. At the center there is sort of the master list of actions. The regional monitoring coordinator, currently myself, will maintain a master list of potential regional board actions that support the policy statements. Then this list of actions may range from broad regional policy development to actions that are very focused on a particular type of permit or a particular program. It'll include the full range of actions we might take on given additional or unlimited resources. So the action plan staff report provides more detail on each of these development inputs. Next slide, please. So this figure represents what I call the work planning funnel. And the concept here, which I attempted to illustrate with this slide, is that annual work planning acts as a funnel to consolidate and prioritize the world of potential actions. This is undoubtedly the hardest part of the framework. There are more good ideas and potential actions than we have resources to undertake. We currently do not have any new resources in terms of staffing or funding to tackle climate change mitigation and adaptation. So that is one of the reasons that the strategy, the climate change strategy adopted in 2019, promoted a dual approach of both internal actions and supporting the work of others. So annual work planning, the annual work planning process will be the primary means of vetting potential climate change actions and prioritizing actions for further development and implementation. The vetting process also includes our annual updates to the board, and I will describe those more in just a few slides. So looking at this figure, in the center are the potential actions we could take, as maintained on the master list shown on the previous slide. Then through our annual work planning process, we narrow down those actions to our prioritized actions for the coming fiscal year. So the plan is to focus these prioritized actions in areas with certainty to occur, areas that have existing funding and resources. So we have selected permit renewals and updates, core program reviews, and triennial reviews as sort of priority mechanisms to further our actions. We know that permits will need to be updated or renewed. We know that triennial review will occur, and we periodically conduct core program reviews. So by focusing our internal efforts on areas with existing resources, we can continue to make progress. And as with action development, the staff report provides additional details on these concepts and how this will work. Also in the action plan itself, it describes how the regional monitoring coordinator will work with program staff and managers during permit updates, program reviews, and triennial review to leverage the knowledge of the staff to further develop and implement appropriate climate change actions. These actions might include things such as developing specific conditions, permit conditions or findings, or creating revised monitoring reporting requirements, looking to future conditions and the future impacts of climate change to try and be a bit ahead of the curve in taking action versus just being responsive. Next slide, please. So this slide is a little bit busy, but the intention here is to provide a snapshot of how internal communication and coordination will occur. To achieve the intentions of the framework described in the action plan, we really will need an all-hands approach. Everyone in our organization has a role to play. Ultimately, climate change will impact all of our programs. So we need to start integrating our thinking, our work practices, and our communication. So on this slide, there is communication on both sides of the figure and between the groups on each side. The right side is representative of staff and managers, and the left side is our internal executives and board members. So to provide an example of how this works, is that the regional monitoring coordinator there on the right side in the blue bubble may hear of a potential action from the quarterly climate change meetings that occur with other regional boards and state board. We may hear of something another regional board is doing and think, well, should we consider that for our region? This might be a good fit for our region. Then the regional monitoring coordinator will discuss that idea with the program staff, program managers, and supervisors, and add it to the master list if it supports our policy statements. Our program managers may hear about good ideas through the roundtable meetings that they attend. And then those managers, those program managers or staff, should bring those ideas back to the regional monitoring coordinator for adding to this master list. We'll likely put this list somewhere on the SharePoint where it'll be accessible to everyone and available to all of our managers and supervisors and staff. So the regional monitoring coordinator will work with supervisors and program managers during our annual work planning process to include certain actions. And then these work plans are approved by our executive officer and executive management as shown on the left. Also looking at the left side of the diagram, our board members may hear of or have ideas that they feel are important to the region. These could be from water quality coordinating committee meetings, emerging issues, or items such as Amy raised earlier today in the meeting. And so board members can communicate these issues to our executive officer and staff. So this, a table representing sort of the full roles and responsibilities that we envision is available in the Climate Change Action Plan as Table 2. And that's on bait stamp 823 and 824 of the board packet. And it's quite a lot, but we recognize communication is needed both to generate the list of potential actions and as we prioritize actions through work planning and into implementation. And as a step in sort of rolling out this communication and this plan, I'm planning to present an internal brown bag session this spring, and we are including some discussions at our upcoming work planning meetings. Next slide, please. I said we would get to this, and here we are. The resolution and the strategy directed staff to report annually to the board on progress of specific climate change response actions. So the proposed action plan includes an annual update that will occur at a board meeting. The update will focus on prior year's accomplishments, proposed actions for the coming year, updates on our external partnerships, collaboration and support, and also provide some updates on emerging issues. One of the mechanisms that we've implemented since adoption of the strategy in 2019 is to add a section to our green sheets, part of our board package item, to identify if an item is has a climate change nexus and which policy statements it may support. And this was started to help us track our actions, our climate change actions, and to facilitate reporting out on those at the annual update. You may start to see permits also incorporate findings related to climate change. So you may see that in some upcoming proposed permits this year. On our the proposed internal actions for the coming year, these are determined, as I mentioned, through our annual work planning process that occurs in the spring. And this annual update is an opportunity for the board to provide input or direction on those actions for the coming year, and also on our long-range focus. Sometimes we need to have several years of planning or funding to really take on a certain issue. So it's helpful for the board also to give us input on that long-range perspective and what our priorities might be for the coming few years. The update on emerging issues is going to include, we're going to be fairly focused on major statewide issues or major regional issues. There is a world of climate science out there that is ever evolving and growing, and we can't keep up on all of it. But what we hope to bring as part of this update is so new science that may be relevant to our region, new statewide policies or actions by other state agencies that have relevance to our region and new regulations coming out. We may also occasionally include presentations from regional experts in climate science as part of this update. So the timing of the annual update is still to be fully determined, but will likely occur near the transition of the fiscal year, so likely at a June or July board meeting. And we may combine this update with our priorities and accomplishments item in the future. We are still somewhat working out those details, but we will keep you abreast of when the first annual update is likely to occur. That is the end of my presentation. Next slide, please. We'll go to comments or questions and discussion if there is.
Comments, questions, board member Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, this was a very thorough presentation. You answered my question. I was wondering how we were going to incorporate this into staff reports and presentations moving forward. And so you addressed that. I just look forward to seeing how this all, dovetails in with what we're already doing. It's an important aspect that we need to address. We need to be cognizant of it and throughout all the different layers of the organization and the work that we carry out. But thank you, Mr. Chair. No other questions.
Thank you. Mr. Dias?
No questions. Thank you.
Dr. Horn?
Thank you very much. Lori, this is a lot to get your head around. So I appreciate the hard work and thought that has gone into your report in the presentation. In reading the report, so there's no slide to refer to, looking at table one of examples of ongoing internal and external climate change actions, mm-hmm. There were things I wanted to know more about, and this is probably not the place, but I just am raising things that I would like to know about. One is approximately how many technical advisory committees are staff involved in? I mean, are we talking 10? Are we talking hundreds? Where?
No, I don't have an exact number for you, but it, I would say not in the hundreds, more in the handfuls or something, but I would need to look, especially ongoing ones. Some of these are short-lived. The ones we were, you know, thinking about when we built that table are for some of the restoration projects that go on, some of the larger projects, though I think they're likely technical advisory committees that other folks are participating in too for other programs. So I can do some research and find that out if you're interested.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, if they're for things that are short-term, maybe categories of the kinds of things that occur as opposed to specific. And I mean, I know that there are technical advisory committees that are more permanent associated with BLM stuff and maybe other agencies. So yeah, I was just curious to know more about what tax the staff might be involved in. I would love to know more about the state board's efforts to develop a general permit for large habitat restoration projects and sort of where they are in that process and what are they thinking and all that kind of stuff.
That process is currently the draft CEQA document and draft permit are scheduled to be released to the public very soon. So they had issued their notice of preparation and they have been working on the draft permit and programmatic EIR. And I expect it actually to be released to the public within this month.
Great. Yeah. Could someone make sure I get an email to that effect that that's available? I would like to learn more about that. Now, the other thing is going back to your old job, Lori. Your mention of the timber waiver just triggered in my mind that about 4 years ago the state relaxed regulations on road building for timber projects. And so I have to put some thought into exactly what my question is. But I'd love to know, and so this is just giving you a heads up that this question is coming. I'd like to know, maybe it's an EO report item. I'm not, you know, I certainly don't want to put a huge burden on anyone to give me the answer on this, but I would love to know how that change in the state regulations, what effect it's had on forestry activity and road building in our region. I'll get back to you guys on that.
okay, thank you.
Then, maybe we should talk about what's realistic, you know, for what information is realistic for you to gather to give me. Then on policy statement 3, now this is a really, really important area because of sort of protection of groundwater quality and supply is going to become harder and harder as the temperature increases. Mm-hmm. And there's, I don't know if everyone is aware, I'm sure some of you are, that there is a feedback loop between dry soil and increasing the air temperature because energy is not going into vaporizing liquid water. So it just heats up the soil faster, which then heats up the air faster. And so that leads to the importance of policies that we might be able to put in place to protect and increase the water holding capacity of soil. And that gets back to several of our programs, trying to increase organic matter in soil, trying to reduce soil compaction, reducing salts in soils, and then having, you know, keeping an eye on that agronomic, that fertilization is occurring at agronomic rates and not higher than that. So that's my comment about policy statement 3. But on the bigger picture, where's my note to myself? So I'm wondering, you mentioned the need to have more integration within the staff. And it seems to me that sort of cross-program teams are going to be needed to make this happen and move away from the chain of command approach of communication, if possible. It leads to a whole question about how the staff gets together to get work done. So if a cross-program team is put together to consider some issue, and the team leader, so what authority does the team leader have to give direction to somebody that does not report to that person, you know, that person's not the supervisor for? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of challenges in, actually making this work and getting out of our sort of program silos, because that's the only way that we're really going to address these problems. So does anybody want to respond to that comment?
I can take this one, Mike, okay. If you want.
Sure.
Okay. So one of the things we envision, Amy, really great question. A lot of good comments here too. But the way we envision that working is that we're going to have regularly scheduled quarterly work planning meetings, throughout the fiscal year. And I envision that Lori is going to have a standing item or spot on that agenda for climate change at every single one of those quarterly meetings. And so it would be during those quarterly meetings when she would have an opportunity to bring to the program manager's attention that there's this issue that has come up, or there's this opportunity perhaps that we could work on. And so I envision that as part of that dialogue, we would start talking about, well, who would be good for the job, which staff people would be good, what programs would need to be involved. And then, probably have, an offline discussion with those program managers, those supervisors and staff about the feasibility of pursuing that based on resources and other priorities, obviously. But we would, through the course of those discussions and coordination, work out the whole chain of command in terms of supervisor versus staff and things like that. So I guess my response is that, we are really going to bake that into our work planning. Having Lori at every quarterly meeting, she's going to be, keeping the group abreast of these actions that are the master list of actions, emerging issues coming out of roundtables, et cetera. And then I envision that the coordination piece with staff, supervisors, to formulate those teams that can work on it across unit and cross program to sort of, initiate out of those quarterly work planning meetings.
Okay, thank you.
I've got one other just to round this out. So I see this coming from three different trajectories, and one Ben has already brought up, the work planning. But I don't see this as a silo approach, because you're totally correct. We've got to communicate more effectively and also innovatively. Mm-hmm. So we've also got to look at a couple of other things, and that is our communication across teams. And we're already starting to do that with our all staff meetings, but also having those subject matter experts bring those up, at whether it's a brown bag or specific training for that particular topic, bring that into the conversation. So, because once you're educated on a certain concept and expectations, now you've got a little bit better and more effective way of going forward. And the third way of this three-pronged approach is also the leadership team, whether it's unit supervisors, division managers, myself, thinking in that context, how does this address climate change? Have we looked at that with respect to this particular permitting action? Could we? And could we expand that in a greater sense? So I think that's how we do this in a more holistic approach and not from the silo approach.
Okay, that sounds good. And just one other request. I would love to listen in on your brown bag, Lori, when you get around to giving it, and which is a general request to hear about when brown bags are being presented by staff and for the opportunity for board to listen in. they're interested. That's it. Thank you.
Mr. Sandell.
I have nothing much to add to this. It's been quite thorough, but I am looking forward to seeing the green sheets and other areas permits, to seeing language that specifically identifies that this thing is aimed towards dealing with climate change specifically. So we point them out as we're going. And that's both for our own use internally and also for the public to see that we are addressing it.
Thank you. It has been gratifying to see in the green sheets the appearance of the little box that talks about the relationship of the proposed conversation or action with the climate change policy. And I know that's something that we were looking forward to seeing, and I'm glad that it has made its appearance. It's an excellent piece of work. There's still a lot to be figured out, but one of the biggest challenges to all this is how do you integrate a consideration of our climate change priorities into our everyday actions? And I think it's particularly challenging to us because in a sense, we're not in such a broad policy place that we can tell people broadly what to do about climate, but we can nudge them along as we look at the activities that we actually have an ability to influence. So you guys have done a really great job on this so far. I agree with the comments of Dr. Horn, and particularly the idea that we might be able to share in the information that is presented at the Brown Bag events. I think that would be helpful to all of us. So thank you all very much for this. I believe that brings us to a conclusion of the agenda items for today, except for the last agenda item, which is closed session. There is a separate Teams invitation, I believe, for that closed session, and I think we should all have it. It took me a while to find it, but I think I have. And so what I would suggest is that we join together for that purpose at 4:05. That'll give us close to 15 minutes to get a snack and walk around and stretch a little bit. Kudos to the staff. Thank you to the staff for the work that went into today's presentations and the actions that we took. Oh, one last thought. Maybe Dr. Horn, your question about what the state is doing in terms of large habitat restoration, maybe that's something we could ask Mr. McGuire to share with us since he was inviting us to suggest topics. So if you'd like to do that, I could do that, reach out to him for that, or I'm sure Mr. Plasiak could, either one.
Board Chair, before you enter into closed session, I'd like to read what item it is on the agenda. So it appears as item 11G on the agenda, discussion of personnel matters, authority under the Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision A. Thank you, Board Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much for keeping me on track.
Board Chair, do you anticipate that we'll go beyond 5 p.m. for closed session? Because I can have that extended.
I would hope not.
Yeah, me too.
And so why don't we just say that's our limitation, then we will accomplish what we can accomplish by that point. So let's get back together at 4:05. Thank you for that reminder and little nudge there.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
See you on the other side.
See you in 11 minutes.